We have a number of very charismatic people in this movement, fantastic orators and people who are very inspirational to us. Of them, there are few that are able to come to our conference, give our keynote addresses, and unite all of us behind a single cause for drug law reform. Our speaker today is one of our luminaries, someone who's been an inspiration to all of us. He is the executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance. Please join me with a warm welcome for Ethan Nadelman.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dominic. That was a very nice introduction. And thank you all for getting up at 9. The reason I was down a little bit late was also the phone's ringing. And the front page of the New York Times and other papers. FDA dismisses medical benefit from marijuana, it says. Which FDA? Is that the Fraudulent Data Association? Is that the Fools and Dolts Alliance? I mean, this is, you know, must be the Vioxx folks, or maybe it's the morning after pill, or maybe it's the administration. Of course, it says there's no such thing as global warming, or that, you know, Iraq was. But I mean, I tell you, what's interesting about this piece, just reading this thing through, on the front page of the New York Times, above the fold, right, is the next line. And here we can say to the New York Times, thank you. Political fight widens, it says. Agency reply to Congress contradicts 99 report by U.S. scientists, the Institute of Medicine. And this article is about the conflict that is emerging. Now, when you see something like this, I mean, the question is, what the hell is going on? What is going on at this point? It was 2006. We already have the dozens of studies. You know, people say go to the National Institute of Health website and put in their medical cannabis, and hundreds of things pop up. You know, John Benson, the co-author of the Institute of Medicine report back in '99, who was very leery of any engagement with anybody involved in marijuana, medical marijuana reform, anything like that. Okay. You know, and he's saying this is nonsense. Never mind going back to 1988 and Francis Young and the administrative law hearings of the DEA, right? Never mind that fact. Never mind the fact that right now you have what ASA has this Data Quality Act thing in there waiting for a response, and the government keeps saying, well, we need more time because we need to come up with more evidence, and they're afraid they keep getting sort of independence about this sort of thing. But what you can see here, if you step back one step, two steps, three steps, what you see is this is sort of the craven last grasp, the craven last efforts of a fanatical administration that is obsessed with the issue of marijuana, obsessed with putting forward a not even paternalistic but authoritarian policy in this country. You know, who was part of the review hearing? Was it independent scientists? No, it was the DEA with government scientists. With government scientists, when you have government scientists already resigning because they can't stand the politicization of science in this administration. You know, when John Walters came in, we knew right away. What did John Walters care about? Did he care about drug addiction? Not really. Addicts? No. Treatment? Only if it was coerced or involved God, very clearly on the front page. Right? Did he care about anything at all except the issue of marijuana and except the issue of drug testing our kids? Of trying to turn America ever more into sort of totalitarian-like vision of his right-wing notions. Where did John Walters work in between his stints in the drug czar's office? Did he work in the issue of health? Did he work? No. Where he worked was he went to head the organization of right-wing philanthropies, the philanthropy roundtable. Where did he get his training? At William Bennett's Little Me, right? John Walters, William Bennett's mini-me, you know. Yeah, but you know, if you can't keep talking to me through every sentence, I won't be able to get a speech together here. How about you sit in the back, talk to the guy in front of you? That's okay. I know you're excited. You're excited. It's true. It's true. It's true. But step back another step, and you realize the extent to which this is a matter of weakness. This is an indication of weakness. You know, they know they're losing on this front. They see the numbers everywhere. They see the medical marijuana legislative efforts. They see how things are getting institutionalized and legitimized in California. When you see polls, you know, the poll that came out 2 years ago in Alabama showing 70% of people support legalizing medical marijuana, when the polls show a majority of Republicans supporting it, when those of us at MPP and Normal and DPA talking to folks on the Hill find more and more Republicans going, you know, we're really with you, and you know, we just wish we could say so, right? When you see that our co-sponsors of our legislation all around the country on medical marijuana are prominent Republican legislators who have personal experiences with cancer or MS or other diseases, what you see is that this group driving policy right now, they are not emblematic or typical of the conservative movement in this country. They are the radical fringe of that group. They are what you might call the John Birchers of the war on drugs. Right, you remember, you know, back in the 50s, the 1960s, right, when everybody was anti-communist, right, everybody was against communism. Then you had the John Birchers, who were beyond the pale. They were the ones who believed that the whole Russia-China conflict was just make-believe to kind of trick us into believing they were, right? I mean, they were the ones who were fanaticized. They were the ones who represented a tiny fraction. But they oftentimes did have political power. And what we see here today, with John Walters and those folks, are the John Birchers of the drug war, are the people who have no element of compassion on this thing and who understand. You know, it's the thing that George Lakoff, I think his name's mentioned before, you know, who wrote the book Moral Politics and the other little book Don't Think of an Elephant or something. You know, the guy who's become sort of the new darling of intellectual progressive vision in America. And he makes this point that somebody else put up yesterday about these two different visions of America. You know, the sort of nurturing vision, the one that we identify with progressives or what the compassionate conservative pretends to be about, right? And on the other hand, we have the authoritarian. Two models of parenting apply to society. And which one is going to win out? Now, we know the one that sits in the White House today, right, is the authoritarian one. It is the one that believes that they are, like authoritarian churches and theocratic, you know, administrations in the past, that they are the fount of authority. And that their role as government is to tell us citizens what the facts and what the truth will be, no matter what the science may say, no matter what the evidence may say. It means that people who don't go along with the official government gospel will be removed, will be asked to leave, will be pushed out, or will be put in a situation where they can no longer simultaneously stand up and act out on scientific ethics and work for the U.S. federal government. In a few days, the Drug Czar's office is going to be on its next leg of its tour promoting student drug testing in Milwaukee, right? One of my young associates, Jenny Kern, is going to be up, you know, there, all 23 years of her, you know, challenging the Drug Czar's reps and laying it out there on television and radio and organizing people around this, as we're doing all around the country on this thing. If you look at what's going on medical marijuana and student drug testing, what you see is that therein lies the true passion of this administration. Walters, you saw last year, all of a sudden, the Sheriff's Association, the National Sheriff's Association, lambasted John Walters. So why is he talking about marijuana? Usually sheriffs like talking about marijuana, but now they're freaked out about methamphetamine. For good reason, for pretend reasons, whatever. But between methamphetamine and marijuana, John Walters is this. So you can see he can't give it up. So he goes out there and he talks about methamphetamine. He talks about task force. He's always looking to find ways to put in there the need for coerced treatment and for more criminal sanctions and for more restrictions and all this sort of stuff. But we know where his passion is on this issue. We know what he really wants to be doing is going out there. He's afraid to condemn medical marijuana, right? John Walters will never have a one-on-one debate, nor will other members of the administration ever have a one-on-one debate on this issue. They are afraid. He's surrounded by phalanxes of people to keep him from being exposed to any counter-arguments. He dare not get within a mile's distance or shouting distance of a doctor, of a patient, or of a scientist. Flow in, hide, don't announce where you're going. Find a school that has just started doing student drug testing without cause. Give a little rah-rah speech. Quickly be whisked out to a meeting with the newspaper editors. No debate, please. Let's move on. Now, of course, almost nobody's heard of John Walters, too, except us. I had such mixed feelings about that. I mean, on the one hand, when McCaffrey was up there, you know, all over, flying around, mixing it up, or when Asa Hutchinson, you know, the one good thing about Asa Hutchinson, head of DEA, is he liked to debate. He was a politician. I'll debate, sure. I'll say anything. I want to get up there. Yeah. You know, John Wall, the nice side of that, of course, was that they kept our issue a bit in the news, and they gave us a chance to respond and respond and respond. And now you have John Walters there and Karen Tandy. God, how did I mix that one up? Karen Tandy, you know, you have them, but they don't have a public profile. One's a political hack. The other one's a law enforcement hack, right? They never in the newspapers. Well, the downside of that is we get fewer opportunities to mix it up with them because we know anytime we have a chance to mix it up with them, we take a step forward. The upside of that is it means that they have no voice and they have no plan. They have no voice and they have no plan. And I think what's so beautiful about what happened this morning is it shows the desperation. It shows that they are trying to defend the position of a 20% minority of this country, maybe less at this point, right? The more they dig in on medical marijuana, the more they dig in on an issue where the vast majority of Americans are on our side, the more opportunity we have to push forward and bring more people with us, right? If we're just fighting on the terrain of marijuana legalization where we only have 40%, depends where you are, less than that in the South, more than that in the West, you know, then, you know, they can keep playing on these fears and the issues that were put up there before and the ones that Chris Conrad rolled off in his speech, you know, all the potencies and this and that. But when they're playing on this terrain, when they're trying to say things, which, you know, we found, in fact, that something like 1 out of 3, 30 to 40% of all Americans actually say that they know somebody who uses marijuana for medicinal purposes, right? That this is not some obscure thing, but people know somebody, right? What they're doing is basically saying, as the man caught in bed with his mistress by his wife said, who are you going to believe, me or your own lying eyes? That's where they're at now. That's where they're at. So this is the opportunity right now. This is the opportunity. Now, what I want to know, of course, is how do you all think about how we're going to move this thing forward to another level, right? We know. Excuse me one second. We know that whenever the patients are put forward, we win. We know that. We've seen it. It just keeps building. We know, and I think there's something of a consensus in this movement now, right, that we have to keep pushing medical marijuana forward around the country one way or another. Why? Because every opportunity we have in state legislatures and the media to put patients and doctors up there, all the work that the organizations here that ACE is doing with its increasingly national network and MPP and Normal and DPA and the state-based organizations and SSDP and everybody else, that every time that happens, we move forward, that we advance. The more the patient, and the more we do that also, the more we change the nature of the debate. The more we shift the debate over marijuana from what about the kids to what about the people who use this as medicine. The more we shift this thing into a more of a compassionate vein and away from the fearful vein. We know that. We also know, and I believe, that California, I think the chances are that if marijuana is ever going to be legalized, I mean, this is an interesting question here now, you know, with MPP doing the initiative in Nevada and the numbers beginning to creep up to 50% there and looking at what might happen in Alaska and the little victory that Dominic just described. But I sometimes think that maybe where it's really going to happen is in California. And here's why. Here's why. It's not that the public opinion numbers in favor of legalization in California are quite as high as they are in some other places, but it's that if you ask where in the world is marijuana now sold more openly, more legally than anywhere outside the Netherlands, there's only one answer. California. California. How many medical MCDs, medical cannabis dispensers, whatever we're going to call them, how many of those things exist in California now? 37. How many statewide? 219? 219 cannabis dispensaries. Living in a little bit of fear, never knowing if somebody might come in and the feds might come in. Living in a situation not unlike the Dutch coffee shops lived in the early 1980s. You know, they weren't legal either. They weren't authorized under laws yet, right? Some of them would get poked on and shut down. Some of them because they weren't playing by rules. But more and more, they were becoming legitimized. They were becoming legitimized, right? When you look at what's happening now, when you look at the people with the ID cards, when you look at doctors who are going along this, hundreds, thousands of doctors, right? We have this happening in the other states, of course, in Oregon and Washington and Hawaii and Nevada and other ones as well, right? But what we have here is, what, 100,000 people? Over 100,000 people now, and more coming on in a legitimized way, in a state where even your governor and the former other Republican candidate also say people should be able to use marijuana legally for medicinal purposes. I think that if we start asking the question, where and how is this going to happen, the question to be asked is the medical cannabis dispensary approach, is that the one that's going to get institutionalized, legitimized, regularized, in part because it's going to submit to regulation and to everything that that involves and make the compromises that are involved. And because then when you go back and you ask the public, what is it that you're really scared about, rationally speaking, about making marijuana legal for everybody, for all adults? Oftentimes what we found in our research is what people say is, I don't want it to be out of control. I don't want to be out of control. And we respond very rationally. Well, you don't want me out of control. Keeping it illegal, prohibition makes it out of control, you know? I mean, prohibition pretends to be the ultimate form of regulation when, in fact, prohibition represents the abdication of regulation, right? But then they come back and they go, yeah, I see what you're saying. That makes sense. But still, I mean, making it legal still seems like it's getting out of control. Right? So the intellectual argument is there, but now there's another vehicle coming along, which are the well-regulated cannabis dispensaries. Because what they do offer is a model of control. What they do offer is an outlet of control. What they do offer is something that people can look and see and sometimes smell as an element. Right? As an element of control. It's something that they can see works. Now here's the next question. Who's medical? What's medical? What is medical marijuana mean in a world in which, you know, we're putting, what, tens of millions of young people and now older people on Ritalin and this and that and that and this, and people are on Prozac, you know, and is Viagra medicine? I guess it all depends where you're standing. I mean, you know, it's... In this world, when the pharmaceutical companies are increasingly doing this thing, when every time you turn on the TV, you know, I don't actually watch TV at home, but when I'm in hotel rooms, I turn on the TV, you flick channels, you know, and one commercial after another, you know, do you feel tired? Do you feel nervous? Do you feel anxious? Do you feel sad? Do you feel anything at all? Because we have a pill for you. We have a pill for you. Well, in that world, what does medical marijuana mean? Where is the line between the person whom they would never touch this stuff but for the fact that they were sick and as soon as they're better, not going to use it, right? The case of, say, Richard Brookhiser, National Review, testifying, I basically almost never smoked pot. I only did it when I got cancer. I smoked to deal with the nausea. Once that was done, I stopped, right? You have another, and then you have other people for whom this is pure joy, pure bonus, pure extra, right? Don't raise your hands, right? But in between, everything in between. Well, it seems to me that we already have the model out there. And the question is to keep consolidating the model, making it solider, making it better, making it stronger, more reassuring. Because as public sentiment increasingly moves towards 50% plus in advocating for legal, but we know the stickiness is going to require a much higher number, and as we know that there's no way to go from here to here in our democracy and our federal system to jump from one place to another, it's going to be that system, I believe, that's going to emerge. And when people say those people aren't medical, the answer is going to be in part, well, what is medical? And what is your Viagra? And what is your mood enhancers? And what is this? And what is that? We are offering a controlled system that can work. Now, of course, the other side will come back and say, aha, I told you. For you guys, medical marijuana, as Mark Satter will say, it was about nothing more than legalizing pot for everybody. So all you potheads could just go and get high. And you want to know something? That's part of what it was about, and that's part of what it was not about. Because what we know is that half of the people who voted for Prop 215 did not support the broader legalization of marijuana. And I can even tell you that among the major funders of Prop 215, there was a healthy debate and disagreement about whether this was just about medical marijuana or about something more. Right? Medical marijuana is about medical marijuana. It is about preserving as effectively as we can, as possibly as we can, the rights of patients, them. But of course, it's also true that the thing that ultimately would defend the patients the best would be to simply make it legal. Right? I remember when Lester Grinspoon used to say, you know, marijuana could well be the new aspirin. And I would say, Lester, you know, even if you're right, don't say it. But then a couple of years ago, Britain's leading medical magazine, The Lancet, said it. Okay, Lester, you were right, you know, and go ahead, say it. But, you know, you don't need a prescription for aspirin. You don't need a prescription for a lot of other things. And we shouldn't need a prescription for marijuana as well. But the fact that we don't need a prescription for marijuana doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to build up this marijuana prescription, marijuana recommendation, medical marijuana, cannabis, as thoroughly as possible. Right? What happened in San Francisco this past year with these hard-fought battles and Ross McAreemy and the mayor and everything and the act of different sides and, you know, some, and inevitably when you make a leap forward, some people are going to get hurt, some people are going to benefit. That's going to be the nature of it. And one of the things about building a movement is that the people who are going to get hurt by a change, are they ultimately stepping back and going, I don't want to get hurt. I'm invested. This is my self-interest here. Which, of course, anybody is going to do and has to do because we all have livings and families and kids and all that sort of thing. But are you also going to step back and say, where is this movement going? What sacrifices need to be made in order to further legitimize this thing? Because that's what's going to do it. It's on the ground in California. And then it's in the courts with the case about the woman, I think it was a woman who was, you know, fired because she was smoking marijuana for medicinal purposes in the privacy of her own home, and her employer fired her. And now that case is going to court. And then there's the case, is the government going to have to reimburse people for their medical marijuana the same way they do other medications? Well, maybe we can win that one as well. And if you're a libertarian and don't believe that the government should reimburse anybody for any medications, I hear you. But keep in mind, so long as the government is reimbursing people for medication, let them reimburse for this one too. Right? And maybe the cases, the Wham case and the Rage case in court will go on, but we got to keep building legitimized. And I got to tell you, all around the country, we are counting on you guys in California. We really are. We are counting on you to keep it together, you know, to keep it together and keep building this and institutionalizing this thing. Now, what I want to talk about for the rest of my time here is to say, you know, also, ultimately, the struggle, of course, is not just about marijuana. It's not just about marijuana. It's not just about hemp. It's not just about medical marijuana. It's not just about marijuana and our rights as adult, free human beings, right, to consume this wonderful substance. Many of you have heard me say this before, and I apologize for those of you who have, but let me say it again, because we are building a political movement. And strategically speaking, there are moments when it is healthy for the marijuana law reform movement to move forward on its own, distancing itself from the rest of the drug policy reform movement. But ultimately, both marijuana reform and the broader cause of justice will be empowered by all of this coming together. Now, when you listen to our opponents and they ask or they say, those drug reformers, who are they? I'll tell you who they are. They're potheads. They're druggies. They're people who like to smoke pot, right? They're people who, and all these other negative things. And of course, what's the answer when they make that charge? Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, many of us, in fact, do like to smoke pot. It is true we do like to smoke pot. We are among the tens of millions of Americans who do or have liked to smoke pot. We do like it sometimes with our food, and we like it sometimes at the beach and for a walk in the park. We like it especially at the movies. Sometimes we like it when we're listening to music, and we oftentimes like it when we're engaged in making love. Because we do find this thing a wonderful thing in our lives. We do find that marijuana adds joy, brings joy, that marijuana is something, you know, it's a good thing. Thank you, God, for putting it on this planet. And the reason we are involved in the marijuana law reform movement is not just because we like to smoke pot, because sad to say there are many, many millions of Americans who like to smoke pot and are not involved in the marijuana law reform movement. It is because we like and we benefit from smoking pot, and we believe that its benefits vastly outweigh whatever harms may befall us. But we are also politically conscious human beings. We are citizens with a capital C, because we understand what the meaning of freedom is. We understand what it means to restrain the ability of the government to go into my backyard, into my home, into my car, and into my body, because we believe that these laws are not right, because we believe that nobody should be punished simply for what they are putting into their own bodies, and that that is true not just of those who smoke a joint, but those who take any other psychoactive substance that is out there. And we believe that is our right, our fundamental right. That's who we are. That's who we are. That's who we are. But is that all who we are? No. That's not all who we are, because who else are we? Who else is part of this growing movement to end the war on drugs in America and around the world? We are also the people who hate drugs. We are the people who have seen the worst that drugs can do. We are the people who grew up cleaning up our parents' puke because they were alcoholics. We are the people who have lost our brothers and sisters to heroin overdoses. We are the people who have lost people we love to HIV/AIDS. We are the people who have seen the worst of drug addiction. We have seen people come and steal into our homes. We are the people who don't like marijuana. We are the people for whom we saw our kid get out of marijuana, and marijuana was the stepping stone to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. We are the people who wish marijuana never existed. We're the people, we understand, you may like it, you can use it responsibly, but we cannot. Whether it's genes or whether it's nature or nurture, whatever it may be, we can't use these drugs, and these drugs are bad. And if the world were drug-free, it would be a better world. It would be a better world. But you know something? Just because we hate drugs does not mean that we believe the war on drugs is the way to deal with drugs in our society. Then no matter how much we hate these drugs, no matter how much we hate these drugs, the answer is not prison. The answer is not prosecutors. The answer is not criminal laws. That there is no legitimate basis between addicts based upon the substance that they are addicted to. Just as there is no legitimate basis for distinguishing between the responsible user of alcohol or caffeine and the responsible user of marijuana, cocaine, mushrooms, or LSD, so there is no legitimate basis for distinguishing between the person who is seriously addicted to alcohol or cigarettes or what have you, and the person who is seriously addicted to cocaine, heroin, even marijuana. There is no legitimate basis. No basis for saying, well, you get to fall off the wagon and stumble and recover and do it again and again and again and again and again until you get your life together. And so long as you can get behind the wheel of a car or go out and hurt somebody, you are not the concern of the criminal justice system. But you over here, you who is addicted to a drug, maybe it's heroin, far less dangerous to the human organism than is the booze over there. You're addicted to cocaine or marijuana, far less dangerous than the cigarettes are over there. That you, when you fall off the wagon one day, well, you might be one of those 5 million Americans under probation or parole, in which case you're going back to jail. Or maybe we'll catch you just simply for possession, and then you're going to jail. No, there is no legitimate basis for having an AA meeting that is outside the criminal justice system and an AA meeting that's inside the criminal justice system. One of the fastest growing alliances that we have in the drug policy reform movement is the movement of people in recovery. It's people who have seen the worst that drugs can do and who hate the war on drugs. It's people who have seen the worst that drugs can do, and who do not believe that the criminal justice system did anything to protect them or for other people similarly placed. It is the people who understand that throwing people in prison for a drug addiction may help a few people. Oh, finally, prisons will enable me to turn my life around. It's true for some people. But that it's the fact that that is true for some people, that some people finally get their life together when they get locked up, does not mean you create an entire public policy based upon that model. Ignoring the fact and the extent to which prison is oftentimes the thing that ultimately destroys people and destroys their futures. So this movement, yes, it is the people who love drugs, and it's the people who hate drugs. And it's another group too. You know who else we are? We're the people who don't give a damn about drugs. We're the people who don't use drugs. Or at least we think we don't use drugs. Maybe we drink a little wine. We put our kid on Ritalin. We, you know, our wife's on Prozac. You know, we do that, right? But we don't see ourselves as drug users. We don't see ourselves as drug users. We care about drugs particularly. We're not that interested. You want to get high? Eh. You got a problem with drugs? But you know what we do care about? The Bill of Rights. We care about the Bill of Rights. We care about the U.S. Constitution. We are shamed by the fact of living in a country with 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. We are shamed by living in a country in which hundreds of thousands of people die needlessly of HIV/AIDS because of the absence of needle exchange and other harm reduction measures. Why, all around the world, these programs are now becoming standard operating procedure. Do you know that about a year and a half ago in Iran, right, with the Ayatollahs, right, which has the highest per capita heroin addiction rate in the world, the public health people started getting things going, and then they went to the mullahs, the ayatollahs, and particularly one ayatollah who was a minister of justice, and that ayatollah minister of justice issued a fatwa, a religious edict, proclaiming that methadone and needle exchange were okay under Sharia law. Which begs the question, why can't we get the mullahs in our own country to do the same goddamn thing? We are the people who don't care about drugs, but we care about people living. We care about reducing AIDS. We care about health. We care about the shamefulness of our prison population. We care about our rights. We care about what the United States is doing in foreign countries. We care about the waste of financial resources. We care about the relocation of people to out-of-state and rural areas because of the powers of private prison builders and unions and what have you. We are the people who don't care about drugs but care about all of those things. So there is a movement emerging in this country around the world, and it is the people who love drugs, it is the people who hate drugs, and it is the people who don't care about drugs, but all of whom believe that the war on drugs and the criminal justice system is not the proper way to deal with drugs in our society. I think that is ultimately the crossover message. That is the message that unites normal and all of us with the people in recovery. That's what unites us with the drug treatment world. When the drug treatment world was, most of my people started with pot and that's why they're here now, we're the ones who say, look, maybe, maybe not. But do you think that the war on drugs and the criminal justice system is the right way to go? And if they answer yes, then what you say to them is then you are betraying the most fundamental principles of medical privacy and medical ethics and believing that the criminal justice system has a role to play in dealing with people's health like this. And if you don't think that the criminal justice system has a role to play, then whether you like pot or you hate pot, you are fundamentally with us. I think that this movement can keep growing that way, And I think that's what's ultimately going to empower us. When we had the conference, the Drug Policy Alliance and all the allied organizations in Long Beach in November, you know, 800 people there, you know, the audience was diverse from all around the world. You know, there you had, you know, people, African-Americans, Latinos who had struggled with drug addiction, who had found God, and they were there. You had cops in recovery from the drug war, LEAP, and they were there. Right? You had marijuana, it was all there. It was coming together. Our issues intersecting with libertarian movements and racial justice movements and public health movements, all coming together. Vigorous debates among ourselves, but understanding that there's a bottom line that we all fundamentally care about. That, I believe, is the future of this movement, and it is in that context that marijuana prohibition is going to come to an end in this society. Now, I want to say one last thing. You know, there's something that my colleagues and I are just about at the point of declaring. But I think that what Drug Policy Alliance is going to try to do at the end of this year is pull together some great big little event in San Francisco. Because the time is right. You know, it's interesting. And here I'm just speaking very personally and organizationally. But, you know, 1996... some of this was about my colleagues. It was about Marsha Rosenbaum creating the Linda Smith Center in San Francisco, our first branch office, because working with the mayors and the civil authorities, because this was, you know, the Amsterdam of America, right? This was the place at the cutting edge. It was my colleague Dan Abramson also joining me in 1996. You know, Dan so pivotally involved in drafting Prop 36 and defending the medical marijuana cases and working with Graham Boyd and the ACLU on the case to defend the First Amendment rights of doctors and patients to talk about this. And, of course, it will also be the 10th anniversary of when Prop 215 was passed. None of us could have imagined or envisioned. Thank you to all of you. In 1995, this was a pipe dream. It was a pipe dream. We didn't know that other states, or what a dozen other states would be having this now. It was a pipe dream, and we made it happen. We stepped out for the first time in the major leagues of American politics, and we showed we could win this. And when the other side threw everything they had against us, congressional hearings and the media, everything else, we came back. And when they tried to go to court, we came back there, too. Probably the nicest contribution I ever got in my life was a check for $350,000 from the Drug Czar's office, reimbursing us for attorney's fees. We'll know by the time we have this what's going to happen in these midterm elections. We'll know if we can look for a little more hope and progress in Washington at that time. We'll know then. But, you know, we won't know what the world or our world is going to look like 10 years from now. All we will know is that our chances of success will depend upon our growing as a movement and simultaneously growing as human beings who try to bring out the best in all ourselves and in one another in fighting for reason, justice, compassion, and human rights. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Got it? Thank you.